Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to another episode of Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. My name's Joe Haddo and I'll be the ringmaster for the upcoming War of the Words, which will ensue between two writers a little later on before we meet our fabulous guests. A little bit of admin to get through. Firstly, hello to any new listeners joining us. We're thrilled to have you with us and hope you'll become a regular of the Book Offs. And of course, a big hello and a big thank you to all our loyal, regular listeners who've been with us since the early days, the dawn of time. You know who you are, and we love you. Thanks also to everyone who's been kind enough to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It's so nice to read them, most of them, and see what you think. And if you listen via the podcast app on your iPhone and can spare us 30 seconds, we'd love you to leave us a review there as well. Authors are also very much encouraged to do the same. Finally, I just wanted to mention another bookish podcast that you might like. I mean, don't replace this one with this one, but I've been enjoying it recently and I think you will too. It's called On the Road with Penguin Classics. And in each episode, me old mucker Henry Elliott visits a different literary location with a guest for a relaxed and entertaining conversation. So check it out. So then, to business, and today, as ever, I'm joined by two fabulous authors who are going to be telling us about their books, their writing, what they've enjoyed reading recently, and of course, we will do the book off at the end of our podcast. My first guest is the author of the highly acclaimed young adult novel, The Miseducation of Cameron Post. She has an MFA in fiction from the University of Montana, a PhD in English from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and she's here to tell us all about her new adult novel, Plain Bad Heroines. It's Emily M. Danforth. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And hello.
You've got far too many qualifications to be on this podcast, Emily. I tell you that.
When people read the PhD, I still wonder how anyone ever gave that to me.
Well, Doctor, we'll find out a little bit later. And my second guest is a journalist and an editor who moved to the UK from Germany to work as a carer before the urge to write brought her to journalism. She's worked all over the world, but has always returned to London because there's no better place to find a good story than the top deck of a bus. I couldn't agree more. Here to tell us about her debut novel, The Long, Long Afternoon, it's Inga Vesper. Hello.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you both for being here. The 38 bus is a favourite of mine, Inga.
I'm on the 65 a lot.
Yeah, I miss. Do you know what?
Say, that's the best one.
I have to say, I'm sort of weirdly missing being on the bus in this lockdown pandemic-y time that we're living. I just haven't been on a bus for, well, probably a year now.
I know. It's the perfect place to kind of just let your mind wander. And now I have to like seek out spaces where I can just not do anything. Being on a bus is the perfect excuse to just not do anything at all.
Got a big bus culture in Rhode Island, Emily?
Better busing than many other states. I'll say that, because I think partly just because we're such a small state, so you can. It's just that, you know, it takes 45 minutes to drive from one end of the state to the other, but like 2.5 hours to take a bus. So,
right. Okay. I want to talk first about your new novels before we find out about what books you're putting up for the book off. And I've read these and thoroughly enjoyed them this week. Emily, Plain Bad Heroines. It's hard to miss, isn't it? Because this front cover that you've got is pretty striking.
Yeah, they did a remarkable job. And it's so different than the US cover, which I really love, which feels much more sort of traditionally gothic. And this is just such a bright... Someone described it as one of the characters in the novel is the Selesbian Harper Harper, and someone said to me recently, "This is definitely a Harper Harper cover," and I think that's right. It feels right.
This is sort of like yellow pinks. It's very bold. It's amazing, really. And
yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, I'm glad that we in the UK have owned that cover, but although I'm sure your US one is very nice too. And I'd describe the book a sort of modern gothic horror. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think that would be. I think maybe meta gothic horror would be the word that I would change there. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So tell us about this story then, and about Brooke Hant's School for Girls.
Well, I think, you know, there's sort of, it was a joke that I made about the novel that's become, I think, more useful as a tagline to describe sort of this big, messy novel, which is that it, Plain Bad Heroines is essentially Picnic at Hanging Rock plus the Blair Witch Project times lesbians. And I think that, like, it's pretty true in terms of what the novel is. It's roughly divided between two time periods, one right around the turn of the 20th century, 1902-ish, at a boarding school for girls in Rhode Island that seems to be under the grips of a curse related to a very real memoir by a writer named Mary MacLean. And so that's roughly one of the time periods of the novel, is following that book and the curse as it passes hands through the students. The present day, or near to present day, timeline of the novel follows the making of a cursed horror movie that's about that curse, and is filming at Brooke Hant's. And obviously the two stories intersect and reflect and comment on each other. You know, for 600 pages, but that's the roughest way I can kind of tell you. It's also a gothic novel that's has tongue firmly in cheek, as Vincent Price used to say sometimes. So it's very aware. It's a gothic novel that is very aware that it's a gothic novel.
Yes, I think that's the perfect little summation at the end there. Very good. And Ingo, let's talk about The Long, Long Afternoon. Another beautiful front cover, I must say. Just slightly subtler than Emily's, this one, though, I think.
Yes, although it does have a lot going on. So if, you know, it depicts a 1950s kitchen with a sort of sun streaming in through the window, but there are a lot of little things wrong with this kitchen. And I think it's very exciting. I've heard from a lot of people who have read the book and then went back to look at the cover, and they spot all of these little clues that pertain to things that happen in the story that are not quite obvious when you first look at it. So I think it's a cover that, you know, has a lot to give in a way.
Oh, I'm gonna have to relook at it then, aren't I? I'm gonna have to inspect it a little bit further. And in this novel, you transport us to the late 50s and to the trimmed lawns of sunny California. But can you tease us a little bit about what this story is?
Yes, of course. It starts with the disappearance of one of those perfect 1950s Californian housewife. Her name is Joyce Haney. She's got two beautiful children. She lives in a beautiful house. She's got a loving husband. And one day, her cleaner arrives to find that she is missing. There is a bloodstain in the kitchen. The kids are alone at home. And nobody knows what's happened to her. And the detective who is tasked with the case very quickly runs into a lot of dead ends, because there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with her life. And she lives in this perfectly safe, perfectly wonderful neighborhood. But Ruby Wright, the cleaner, knows a lot more about what's going on in this neighborhood. However, she is an African-American woman from South Central, and for her, the police are the problem and not the solution. And the last thing she wants to do is get, you know, in trouble over something that happened to her white employers. So those two characters, the detective and Ruby, have to come together to solve the mystery of what happened to Joyce. But then throughout the novel, we do hear from Joyce as well about the day that she disappeared and all of the things that happened. That gives you some clues as to what might have happened to her.
Now, regular listeners to this podcast know how much I wang on about California. And they're probably thinking right now, oh, Joe, shut up about LA and wine country and all that business. But I do love California, and there's something quite intoxicating about 1950s California, especially, I would say. I want to ask you in a moment, Emily, as our resident American, about that. But first, Inga, what drew you to this particular time period?
Okay, I'm going to have to make a horrible confession here now. I have never been to California. I think Emily's going to knock me over the head. So
No, not at all.
So
it just shows how enchanted you are from afar.
Exactly.
California.
And I think that's it, because it just symbolizes this sort of this traditional, you know, the American dream that we have of the open skies and the highways and the palm trees, and everything is sunlit and beautiful and technicolor. And actually, for me, there is something quite dark underneath all of that perfection. And I wanted to scrape away. I mean, you know, I wanted to write a book about, I wanted to write, you know, a thrilling crime novel, but one that had sort of feminist elements in it and that looked beyond the surface of these perfect lives. And California just seems the perfect place to set it, because it is so present in all of our lives, and, you know, to kind of scratch away at that dream a little bit was just a lot of fun.
There was there's a slight sort of I don't know, like, if you've seen Mulholland Drive, the David Lynch film, there's that sort of shimmer on the surface of LA, specifically in California, but then there's this darkness underneath, and I feel like that's what you were sort of getting out of the pages of this book and the chapter. It was that it seems shiny and good, but actually underneath it's all a bit twisted.
Yes, exactly, because a lot of the, you know, the 1950s, we often look back at this age with a sort of, you know, a lot of nostalgia, but actually it was a really, really dark time for a lot of people. It was a horrendous time for African Americans. It was a horrendous time for many women. Sexism was absolutely rife. Women weren't allowed to do the most basic things, and I think we forget about that. We forget that all of that kind of, you know, glamour and perfection was built on some very, very horrific foundations, and that's what I really wanted to explore.
Yeah, have you been to California, Emily? Are you a fan like me?
I am a fan, and I have been several times. And I think that I grew up. I'm sure, you know, I don't know that it is, hearing both of you talk, at all uniquely American, also romanticizing, particularly Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
And sort of the idea of what's possible there, the shimmer of the sky and the palm trees. But I, you know, I've come to really appreciate, I think, when I've gone, and specifically sort of parts of LA, you know, the things that people that live in California complain about, the traffic and the street, you know, there's something that that feels just very authentic, I guess, about the experience. And I think probably because I've always been in tourist mode, I've never visited and not loved my time in California. So, and it shows up actually in my novel as well, with characters who are visiting LA for the first time, and or at least one, and are kind of enchanted and simultaneously dubious about the glitter. Very aware.
Yes, very aware indeed. But you, as we established, you live in Rhode Island, so you're on the East Coast. But mm-hmm. you're by the sea, aren't you? You're by the water.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Rhode Island is the ocean state. So, yeah, and that was something that I really plays a significant role in Plain Bad Heroines, as it does in so many gothic novels. And I wanted to establish that in this tiny state, the Brookhaunts estate, which contains both a boarding school and a house, this manor house, feel very isolated, which is something that both the historic characters and the contemporary characters kind of comment on. How, right, in tiny Rhode Island, can there be a place that sort of seems far away? I think that when we talk about haunted New England or gothic New England, Rhode Island often gets overlooked for Vermont and Massachusetts, and I'm staking my claim that Rhode Island's got plenty of ghost stories too.
Yes, fantastic. Because actually, I hadn't really thought about it until just now and you speaking about it, but I wonder if, I don't know if a sort of ghost gothic story, especially when you're talking about, you know, that remoteness that you need, that isolation that you need to sort of conjure up. I don't know if you could set something like that in, well, certainly not LA or London, just because there's people everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd have to figure out a different way to isolate someone, right? I mean, the pandemic has provided plenty of those, but yeah, it would be a different kind of isolation, certainly. It wouldn't be, you know, miles to drive to the nearest neighbor, so
yeah, true. And was it a specific choice for this novel to be for adults? Because obviously you've previously written YA fiction. Did the story lend itself to being an adult novel, or did you plan it?
I didn't know. People ask where does the novel come from, and really, I started with this idea. I've always been a fan of cursed films, right? They're supposedly cursed films. Sometimes the marketing department is the biggest part of the curse, but I've always been really interested in them, and they tend to accumulate much more around horror films, right? This idea that there was some malevolent force on set keeping a film from being made, and so I wanted to write about the making essentially of a cursed horror film and a queer horror film that would, you know, be sort of expressly queer. And when I was conceiving that novel, it was going to be YA, and it really was going to follow younger characters on set, you know, sort of hopping heads amongst three of them, making that movie. But in answering for myself, really, just as the novelist, why the location they were making this movie at was haunted, and trying to figure out what the curse was, I became more and more enamored with doing, you know, sort of Gilded Age research into women's colleges and boarding schools, and it became pretty clear to me that I wanted to put that material in the book, and it wasn't going to be whatever the other novel I thought I was going to write, you know, was. And at that point, partly because the characters I wanted to follow were not just students, but the women that run the boarding school, it just, for all kinds of reasons, it was, you know, it was evident it was no longer a YA novel. But that was, you know, really, I'm a slow novelist, and that was a years-long process. You know, it wasn't something that I worked out in a couple of weeks, so.
Didn't just kind of go, oh yeah, no, I know what I'm doing. I'm writing it this way.
No.
So what of, did you have, you know, film nights for research where you were watching some of these horror films?
I didn't have to, that's just my life regularly, so I didn't have to do sort of special research horror nights. That's what my weekend looks like, much to my wife's unhappiness, who does not like horror movies at all, so I have to like sneak them on my laptop, but she'll come in the room and doesn't even want it like on my laptop. But I did that, but I also, you know, I read turn of the century ghost stories. I really steeped myself, obviously in Henry James, but also Edith Wharton. And the book that's mentioned, you know, that I mentioned, Mary MacLean's memoir, that plays a much more significant role throughout the novel than I thought it was going to. And just a little background, because it's criminally underknown, unfortunately. Mary MacLean was a 19-year-old living in Butte, Montana, this mining town, when she set out to write essentially what she called her portrayal, which was this very confessional kind of look at her life as a teenager in Butte, Montana at the turn of the century. And she beseeches the devil throughout it. She originally wanted it titled I Await the Devil's Coming, and asked the devil to come and rescue her from this barren, you know, wasteland of Butte, Montana. And she also lusts after her high school teacher, a woman, Fanny Corbin, throughout it, really in pretty explicit prose, again, for, you know, turn of the 20th century. And her wish came true. I mean, I couldn't have made this story up. The exact thing she wanted the memoir to do happened, which is that it was published and she became an overnight sensation. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. It received, you know, press in like sort of every newspaper in the country at a time when you know, every town had five newspapers. And not, you know, often not good press, right? Although she had certainly her fans, but it really lifted her up out of obscurity. Made her a sensation for a time, you know, sort of, you know, I've heard her described as kind of like the first influencer, right? Or like an early kind of pop star in that way. So that book plays a role as well, a much larger role than I initially thought that it would. So
yeah. Ah, fantastic. What about you, Inga, we've mentioned buses as a good place to get ideas from. Where did the inspiration for this story come from?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to mention this on a podcast, but I was very bored at work one day, and I like to look at, as I'm a journalist, I like to look at, you know, stuff on the internet. And so what you do is you go to Wikipedia, you look at what's on the front page, see if there's anything interesting. And I came across the disappearance of a movie star called Jean Spangler. I think she vanished in 1956 or something. And, you know, you go to the bottom of the article and there's a list, like Wikipedia does. It says list of people who vanished mysteriously. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. Let's have a look. And it's a list that starts with sort of someone who vanished in the year 4000 BC. And goes on from there.
Oh my
gosh. And
what
I noticed, you know, it's incredible. There's thousands of people who just vanish without a trace. And what I noticed scrolling through the list was that from the year 4000 BC until about the 1940s, there were always men, and they vanished whilst exploring the Amazon or fighting some war or doing some sort of, you know, looking for El Dorado. And then from the 40s and 50s, especially in the 50s, you start women going missing, and the suspicion is almost always that they were murdered. And I looked at this and I thought, this is so depressing. Men vanish whilst furthering humanity and women get killed. And that sort of, I don't know, for some reason, it completely inspired me in a way that I felt like I want to look into these women who went missing in the 50s and see what was going on. So that was really... like one big piece of inspiration for me. And then the other thing is that I used to work at the coroner's court. It was one of my first jobs as a journalist, and which is for international readers, which is a court where the cause of death is established. So if you find a body and it's not clear why that person died, go to the coroner's court. And so I used to sit there for days and just watch cases after case after case, and the families are usually there. And so when someone has just died in your family, that's obviously it's a really extremely emotional time. And reacting, like watching families react to the news of someone, you know, a loved one dying under suspicious circumstances, that was really interesting. And some of those cases went on to become cases of crime. And so just being able to observe that was extremely fascinating for me. And because what you see is that a lot of these families, you know, things have been going wrong for many, many, many years, but often things were not addressed. They weren't spoken about. So you could kind of tell, you know, the death of a person sometimes was the culmination of many, many years of secrecy among people who were very, very close to each other and, you know, married or brothers or something like that. And I kept wondering, how could that happen, that people live together and are so close and yet have these terrible secrets? And so that was another inspiration for the book.
I think it's perfectly fine to be a little bit bored at work and go searching for, you know, a bit of inspiration, wouldn't you say, Emily?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm thinking, like, you mentioned that list of 100 names or hundreds of names. I mean, I'm thinking you might, like, there's probably, what, 6 more novels in there, right? Right? Yeah, yeah. You know, you've sort of dug one out, but I'm, you know, immediately the novelist in me is going, huh, that sounds like a great list. That sounds really useful.
But isn't it, would you say it's true, certainly of a journalist, Inga, but Emily, also of novelists, you know, when you do stumble across a story or a character or even just like the germ of a story, you as a storyteller really want to know more about it. And that is where, you know, so often great stories, great novels come from.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I think that you're not, I mean, I think for me, it's usually a desire to ask more questions, right? If something seems particularly interesting, I want to, I assume that I don't, that I've only seen part of it, right? If I'm thinking of it, like you read something on a news feed or something, and that asking more questions then leads you down rabbit holes that, yeah, where you find stories. So certainly.
And I think it's that just that need to know to continue that story. So, you know, I wanted an answer to all of these women who went missing in the 50s. I felt like I want to know what happened to you, because, you know, no one ever found out. And so it was just very interesting to then sort of spin that story further in your mind and kind of feel like you can, you know, it's all made up, obviously. It's not an answer, but just to explore that phenomenon even and you know, make up an answer to at least one of these fictional women was quite satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if either of you have read Rachel Harrison's book. It published last year, The Return, but it's the premise is that so it's a little more specific of a you know, kind of unfortunate phenomenon of people that go missing while hiking or camping. And there are certain areas in the country that just have tons of those, where again, like, no information, sort of never seen again.
I've never googled an American national park ever, because it sounds like never. The most dangerous place in the world.
Oh no. Well, some of them are very beautiful and you'll have a lovely time, but I understand. I feel like I have my most patriotic defending the national parks.
No, it's all right.
Okay, good. Yeah, but she just took the premise of someone that happening. There's a group of college friends and one disappears and there's no, you know, hiking and there's no information. And then after 2 years, the friend returns, hence the name, The Return. And there's not a lot of information about, you know, where exactly she's been. She's not able to provide much. It's a really, you know, it's an interesting premise, and I think it's a really great novel. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense that so many storytellers are drawn to trying to answer those unknowns.
Yeah. And speaking of books that you've read and enjoyed, I always like to ask my guests about things they've been reading recently. They don't have to be new books necessarily, but it's always nice to have some recommendations from you. So Inga, have you been finding some time to read? Is there anything, you know, that you've read recently you'd like to recommend to everyone?
Oh, yes, I have just delved into C.J. Tudor, and I think she's a perfect author to mention. Emily, I'm sure Emily's already fully aware of her, but if Emily's readers will love C.J. Tudor, she writes sort of, you know, gothic, mysterious, unsettling, weird stories that are set in the UK. They're not necessarily crime novels, although crime is always involved, or quite often involved, but then, you know, you sort of, as the story continues, something very dark and uncanny comes up, and it's never quite clear whether it's, you know, a ghost or a spirit or some sort of malice. And they're just absolutely incredibly stunning and exciting and thrilling stories. It's very, very difficult to describe what a C.J. Tudor book is to someone who hasn't read one, but highly, highly recommended.
Oh, brilliant. Well, actually, Kaz was on this very podcast just a few episodes ago, talking about The Burning Girls, which is her latest one.
Yes. And we talked about, I shall say no more then.
Well, exactly. We can point people back to the episode with C.J. Tudor and Will Deed if you want to find out more about that. But I completely agree with you, Inga. Great novelist and some fabulous stories. Thank you for that one. And what about you, Emily? Anything you want to recommend?
Absolutely. I recently read Melinda Lowe's young adult novel last night at the Telegraph Club. And it's a work of historical fiction. It's set in the 50s in San Francisco, largely in Chinatown, against the backdrop of the Red Scare. And it's two, you know, high school students, two teen girls, and their romance story, really, their love affair, with, again, this very sort of racist backdrop, and paranoid backdrop of the Red Scare at that time. And Melinda just did sort of phenomenal research for this book. You see the world of drag bars and queer bars of San Francisco 1950s. And it's really just, it's gorgeously written. And it's out in the States. It was out in the States in January, and I know it's going to be out in the UK in March. So it's Last Night at the Telegraph Club by Melinda Lowe. She's one of my favorite contemporary young adult novelists, and I think this is her best book. It's so good.
Fantastic. And great title as well. Love that. And before we do the book off, I do want to ask about YA, actually, because I'm a huge fan of young adult literature, Emily, and I know that authors and readers and publishers and people in the publicity departments and, you know, everyone has a slightly different idea on YA and whether we should call it young adult, whether it makes any difference really, if it pigeonholes it, if it doesn't, if we need it for marketing, if we don't. I personally think when I hear YA, young adult novel, I sort of know the kind of novel that I will be reading, and yet I would not be put off by it if I heard that term. I just wonder what your thoughts on it are, because as a fan myself of just reading YA, you know, I would recommend it to anyone if I read a good book. And I just wondered what you thought of the sort of constraints or non-constraints of calling it YA are.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that having that designation, I too am not someone who thinks of it as a genre designation so much as a classification that tells me that writers are writing about largely adolescent characters. And in some cases, in a much more pointed way, they are writing for adolescent readers, and they're, you know, YA novelists that talk a lot about that as a thing that's driving them. But I usually, it's just a classification to know that novel's going to be about teenagers, right?
Yeah.
Or that work of nonfiction is going to be about teenagers. And usually have some sort of elements of a coming-of-age novel. But yeah, I think that there is sort of an unfortunate, maybe lingering essence sometimes of literary snobbery about YA that I still keep waiting for just to sort of explode and vanish, because I think some of the most interesting novels published every year are young adult. And that's been true for a long time. It's not like this is something, you know, that's, well, just in 2020 has this. This has been true for a long time now, right? It's not a recent phenomenon. So I'm like you. I move freely between young adult and novels published for adult, and I don't really give a lot of thought about that. But I will say that YA is very useful, at least in terms of helping younger readers, right, find books that reflect their experiences. And in that way, I think the designation does matter, right? That they that more than ever, actually, that readers are able to see themselves on the page and know they can go to YA novels to do that. So
absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the really important part of it. Because I have to say, I've got strong feelings about this, because I've often sort of passed or young adult has passed me by a lot, because I thought, well, then it's not for me, because I'm not really a young adult anymore. But then every time I've read a book that was designated as YA, I found it hugely enjoyable. And I've been thinking, wow, I've been missing out on this whole like slice of the literary world, just because I thought, oh, maybe I'm just a bit, maybe this is just all about romance and, I don't know, high school. And actually, it really is not. So I wonder almost if we need, you know, a designation that's something like, this is YA, but it means it's for adults also.
Or like, I think we just need more of us to loudly say, right? Yes, no, it's for you. It's for you. You don't have to change the title.
It's for everybody.
You, right?
And it can cover really, really deep and important themes. And, you know, there's a thrilling, pacey stories. And it's nothing that's, it's not at all like anything that's sort of dumbed down or something that, you know, young people wouldn't be ready for. In fact, quite the opposite. I think there's a lot going on in YA that, you know, the classical adult literature world could, you know, learn something from. So
absolutely, it's a refreshing amount of honesty on the page. Yeah,
yeah.
There really is, I think, and it's just, I think it YA as do children's books. They sort of allow for the imagination of the author and the reader to really open up. And one thing I was going to say, Emily, is I don't know about you or you, Inga, but when I pass on a YA book, if I'm recommending it, I don't actually mention that it's YA. I just go, I think you'd really like this. And in the case very recently of the latest Angie Thomas book, which is called Concrete Rose, you know, the person I recommended it to had no idea that it wasn't, you know, a book for adults, and were really surprised when I said, oh, actually, it's a YA novel.
Yeah. I do think there are readers that are really missing books that they would love, just because maybe snobbery is unfair. There are certainly some snobby readers, but sometimes I think it's just, those are books for younger readers, right? And I don't, you know, maybe for some of us too, I think it's thinking about, not that there weren't great novels published for adolescents and younger readers when I was younger, but I think maybe kind of, you know, you're an adult and you're holding on to the memories of what you were reading, right? And I don't think they realize quite how expansive the world of young adult literature looks right now. So novels in verse, right? I mean, I just like how much interesting work is there. So, yeah.
So we're very much flying the flag for YA. And anyone listening who's thinking, oh, do you know what, I should really try some YA, then Miseducation of Cameron Post is a pretty good place to start, isn't it? So maybe listeners should get themselves a coffee.
You've done this before. Wow. Way to slip that in there.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Right, it's time now for the book off, and this is where each of you gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book that you love, that you think that me and everyone listening should read. First things first, we need to decide who goes first and who goes second, and we need to decide who's getting rung out by the bell and who is getting honked out by the bicycle horn. So, Inga, would you like to go first? She's jumped in. You want the bicycle horn? Fine.
She's taking it.
That's it. Emily, that means you get the school bell, which is sort of appropriate, really, isn't it? I suppose.
I'm charmed by both, so I'm fine.
And would you like to go first or second, Emily?
Well, I will defer. I'll go second, and I'll let Inga go first.
Okay, very good. Before we hear your pitches, let's find out which books you're putting forward. Emily, which one are you talking about?
I am talking about The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson.
Ooh, fantastic. And Inga, which book are you putting up for the book off today?
I am talking about Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc.
Alrighty, fantastic. Well, you've got 3 minutes. As I said, you don't have to use it all. But as soon as you hit the 3 minute mark, I'm going to be honking you out, Inga, and ringing you out, Emily, to cut you off. So I'll keep quiet. And it's over to you, Inga, first. 3 minutes on the clock to tell us about Random Family.
So I think everybody needs to read Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. It's a nonfiction book that deals with teenagers who are dealing drugs in 1985 in the Bronx, and it especially deals with the women, the girls, girlfriends of drug dealers and their lives. It's an amazing piece of reporting. So the author got to know these girls during a trial and then followed their stories for the next 15 years. So it goes up into the early 2000s. And it really is an incredible piece of writing, because what the author did, Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, she got to know these women so well that she gave them recorders so they would just record themselves during their day. And she did a lot of transcribing of these recordings and then wrote the book directly from their perspective. So Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, as the author, is never actually in it. And she uses the way people speak, she uses their phrases, she uses Spanish and Latino phrases a lot. And so what you get is an account of what that life is like, this life of extremes, of extreme wealth and extreme poverty and extreme violence, told directly from the point of view of the characters. And it's just an incredible tour de force, and really, really important, I think, for people to understand what poverty is like and what, you know, how it kind of holds you back and how your thinking changes with the struggles that you are facing. I found it extremely insightful. But then the writing style really helps you to, I think, be directly there when these things happen and directly understand the actions of the characters. And for authors or for anyone who loves literature, that's an incredible tool to have, because it really taught me so much about how you portray characters honestly and do it directly from their soul, I would almost say, rather than pretending to be some kind of bridge between, you know, the character and the reader and pretending to explain too much. So it's just an absolutely stunning book, and I do think it really needs much more attention, and I think it flew kind of under the radar when it was first published. But if you've ever, like, if you read any sort of true crime, if you read Truman Capote, if you read any of those, you know, big names, Adrien Nicole Leblanc is certainly one to watch, and yeah, an absolutely incredible book.
Fantastic. Oh, I brought it in and just 2.5 minutes, a casual sort of 2.5 minutes in, just like, yeah, I've said all I need to say. Love it. Very good. Thank you for that. Take a breather. Have a rest. I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock for you now, Emily, to tell us about The Haunting of Hill House. Over to you.
All right, so you've probably heard of The Haunting of Hill House, even if you haven't had the pleasure of reading it. And I had, and I'll walk you through. I was in college. I'd been assigned the book. Its premise, which is that a paranormal researcher gathers some strangers at a haunted house, supposedly haunted house, kind of surrounded by some creepy hills, felt a little cliche to me, although I didn't know at the time. It felt cliche to me, largely due to Shirley Jackson making it a cliche. And I thought that I was maybe a little smarter than this book, and then found myself, and this is a common story with The Haunting of Hill House, beginning it in the afternoon, not being able to stop turning pages, feeling rather locked in the novel, but delighting in that, and finishing it in one evening, which you can easily do. It's 180 pages. There is not a word wasted. And then being too afraid to walk out of my dorm room down the hallway to the bathroom, really for the night until it became dawn and I felt safe doing that. So if you're looking for a haunted house novel that delivers terror, that delivers the scares, everyone from Carmen Maria Machado to Neil Gaiman have named this as the scariest novel they've ever written, if that's a thing that you're looking for. But beyond that, I think that Jackson's prose is just, it's so restrained. I said economical earlier, and her insights into the characters, who I think easily could have just been types or unlikable, particularly Eleanor, whose consciousness we're most closely tied to, and Theo, who, you know, for a book written in the 1950s, is a queer bohemian. She lives with a woman. Those characters feel so astoundingly real, that when Eleanor starts being haunted by this house, you as a reader start feeling possessed by the house. You're so locked to her. It's just like an astounding piece of writing. And again, that she pulled it off in 180 pages feels unreal. So I feel like I have to make the case for reading The Haunting of Hill House because in the last decade or so, people have really rediscovered this novel, a famous Netflix series, which is great, by Mike Flanagan, that sort of loosely takes off on it, was made. And I think in all of that, that's wonderful. But sometimes then what I find is that people don't read the book because they feel like they already know the premise of the book. People in a scary house investigating the paranormal. And you're really missing the experience of being put in that world in the most unsettling way. So, and I think I have just a little bit of time left. I'm going to read from the beginning. It's one of the most famous openings of any novel. No live organism can continue for long to exist sanely under conditions of absolute reality. Even larks and katydids are supposed by some to dream. Hill House, not sane, stood by itself again. I got to read part of the beginning.
You did. And I think that was a lovely little tease of the beginning there. And a wonderful pitch as well. Thank you so much. Thank you both for those. Now, I have read Haunting of Hill House. And I am one of those people, Emily, that came to it quite recently. You know, I didn't read it to study it. I actually watched a film with the wonderful Elizabeth Moss in, which was about Shirley Jackson. It was her portraying Shirley Jackson. Yeah, Shirley. And it made me think, oh, I haven't read much Shirley Jackson. And then a colleague of mine said that Haunting of Hill House was like poetry, like amazing poetry. And so I read it. And exactly as you said, I just sort of fell in love with it. I couldn't put it down. I was really sucked in. And so lots of things that you were saying there in that pitch, I was like, me too. But Ingo, I don't know of Adrien Nicole Leblanc, and I don't know of this book, Random Family, but wow, it sounds brilliant. I wasn't expecting what you were saying in that pitch, actually. And the more you were talking, the more I thought, oh, this just sounds fascinating. The thing that got me the most, I think, is like the fact that she got them to record themselves.
Yes.
And then transcribed that voice.
Yeah. And I think it's just the most incredible tool for any author, but also for journalists, the fact that you hear directly from the people you are covering rather than trying to put your own spin on it. And that's why it's just such a tour de force, honestly. Yeah, it's, again, it's absolutely unputdownable. When I first got it, it's very, very long. I don't know how many pages. I think it's about 300 pages, but very small text. I just couldn't put it down. I read it over like 2 days constantly.
Wow. I mean, yeah.
It convince just, me. I will.
Yeah.
Yes.
I will absolutely be reading it. So, yeah. No question.
I think it's fair to say, maybe I'm wrong here, but I think it would be fair to say it's like, that's the sort of book I would not find myself and I wouldn't pick up. Now, Shirley Jackson, on the other hand, like, you would come to it, perhaps, Emily, because people talk about her and she is, you know, regarded in literature and, you know, it is a famous book. In fact, what you said about...
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
And what you said about, you know, before you read it, you felt like it was a bit of a cliche, but actually she invented the cliche, which I just think is so brilliant because that's true.
That's why, yeah.
Yeah, you go, oh, right, no wonder I think I've heard this before because, okay, it all comes from this. But I did love The Haunting of Hill House when I read it, and I thought that your pitch for it was absolutely wonderful. I'm absolutely intrigued by Random Family now, Inga, for all the reasons that you said. So I've got to pick one to take home, and the winner of the book off is going to be Random Family.
Woo!
I think we need to maybe celebrate a bit of the underdog here in this one. I think it sounds absolutely fascinating. But I would say, as I'm sure you would, Emily, you've got to read Haunting a Hill House, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yes, I'm glad that you picked Random Family, and not that it matters what my feelings are. I'm glad. But I think it's a weird book where there was a period not that long ago where people really weren't reading Jackson. And now there's been, like I said, in the last decade, this kind of Jackson resurgence, and everybody's like, oh, of course, The Haunting of Hill House. But now that kind of legend of her is so big that I'm like, are people still not actually reading the book, though? You know,
they're just, exactly.
Yeah, right. No, I know who she, you know, I'm like, but you got to read the book, right? The book is the thing. So
you're so right. Don't just watch a Netflix series or whatever. Get to the books. Get to the heart of the prose.
Yes.
And you're so right with the 180 pages. I mean, it flies by, and you sort of just can't believe that you've had a whole story in that time. And Inga, thank you for bringing Random Family to our attention. I am absolutely going to be reading this book. I've already noted it down, and it's on the big long list of books that I'll be ordering from bookshop.org very soon.
Thank you so much for choosing it. I really think you'll love it. You absolutely will. If you like my book, then you will love Random Family.
And that book is The Long, Long Afternoon by Inga Vesper. It's out now from Manila Press. And Plain Bad Heroines by Emily M. Danforth is also out now, and it's published by Borough Press. And we recommend both of those wholeheartedly because they are absolutely brilliant reads, and I very much enjoyed both of them this week. Emily, Inga, been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.